Yo, hey everyone, welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. This is week two in our series of compilation episodes, and today's show is all about food. So we hear from Dr. Hazel Wallace. We're talking about the fundamental principles of nutrition. We hear from Max Lowry, author of Two Meal Day, and he's talking to us about intermittent fasting. I chat to Dr. Rupi Orjula about culinary medicine, and we also hear from Dr. Megan Rossi about all things related to gut health. I really hope that you enjoy listening to today's episode, but please remember, if you have any health conditions, then you must see your own doctor before making changes to your diet. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy. So online, you are the food medic and you talk a lot about food. And I think as well as giving, you know, really delicious recipes and food inspo, you also do a lot of extensive research, which you then distill into either, you know, a blog post or a social media post. So at the moment, I feel like there is so much information out there about food. It's mad. Yeah. Oh, gosh. It's like the nation is obsessed with food, you know, what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat. There's debates about, you know, veganism, keto diet, intermittent fasting, seasonal eating, superfoods, so much information that I think many people are finding it really overwhelming of just knowing, like, what to eat. And, you know, these shocking headlines, like, we're being told, like, these superfoods are really good for you. And then the next week we're being told, like, for example, coconut oil, you know, that it, there was a headline about that being poisonous. And it's so confusing for people. So personally, I know the notion of, like, a balanced diet, I just don't think is very useful for a lot of people because they've lost what balanced is.
No.
So Hazel, can you break it down for us? Can you simplify it for us? What on earth should we be eating?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's super confusing, and the headlines say one thing, the science says another thing, and that changes day on day. And it's even more confusing because I think we're all so focused on what we shouldn't be eating, and it produces this very reductionist way of looking at food, and also kind of isolates lots of important foods as well. I also think we focus too much on nutrients as opposed to food. So we say, like, you know, we're talking about carbs one day or fats the next day, like, how much protein should you be having? And, like, we get bogged down on the numbers, but, like, in terms of real life application, unless you're, like, a bodybuilder or, like, athlete, you're not going to be weighing your carbohydrates, and you don't need to be. And the same thing goes to, like, a balanced diet or a balanced plate. I think, like, if we want to try summarize what that might look like, it would be, you know, palm-sized portion of protein, some veggies, and, like, a fistful of complex carbohydrates and some healthy fats. But not every meal looks like that. Like, a bowl of porridge doesn't look like that, like, unless you're having a meal that where you separate all your food. So I think that's really difficult for people to understand. And also, going back to the science, nutritional science is relatively new, and I think the key when it comes to interpreting the science is that it's interpreted from someone who's researched or well read in that field, because most of the studies, and not all of them, are observational. So we look at people and we ask them to take, like, a food diary or a questionnaire on the foods that they've eaten. But the reason that's not perfect is because lots of people can't remember what they've eaten. And also, we can only make links. So we can only say correlations. We can't say causations. And one of the good examples of that is things like red meat consumption. So, you know, there is a link to say that red meat causes colorectal cancer and certain other conditions, but also we know that people who eat a lot of red meat are probably less likely to be active, eat less vegetables as a result, might smoke, drink alcohol, those kind of things. So there's lots of factors to take into consideration, and when it comes to the science is absolutely key, and I love science, but the interpretation's more important. So when it comes to, like, thinking about what should I eat, and I know we're going to come on to this later, but it's a very personal thing. You know, like, what suits my body is very different to what suits yours. And although there's a general kind of fundamentals that we need, like our minerals and our vitamins and some carbohydrates and some fats and some protein, the ratios and the variation of that is so different, and it you know, it depends on the type of person you are, if you're male, if you're female, if you exercise a lot, where you've come from, even your gut microbiome, everything. You know, it's very variable.
And how can people find out more information that's personal to them? Because do you think that it's time for us to take more responsibility perhaps for our own diets? And as you said, we're all so different. So how can what suits me suit your body or suit somebody else's? And when it comes to, I guess, taking responsibility for your own diet, and is it worth, I don't know, I think sometimes about, like, you know, with your car, you'll go and you'll get an MOT and you'll get all the information, and if you were buying a car, you'd want to know everything about it, but we don't even know things about our own insides. So is it worth, like, doing, I don't know, going to a doctor and saying, I want to have a blood test to see if I'm low in iron, or, you know, what can we actually do to figure out what we need?
I know we've spoken about this before, and I think that can lead to a slippery slope of becoming a bit more of a hypochondriac when it comes to food. And we almost over-pathologize normal bodily functions. And one of the things that I have a bit of a bugbear about is, like, this whole idea that bloating is always a negative thing or always like a pathological process. It's not always. Bloating is actually quite normal, and sometimes you're just a bit bloated because you've had a big meal. That's normal. In some cases, it's not normal, and there's red flags that doctors would look out for if they thought it was not normal. But if you just go and have a blood test just for the hell of it, but you feel okay, you probably won't find very much. And then you might think, well, I'll go have another scan. And then you're putting money in to have a full body scan. You might find something that you didn't want to find, or you might find something that's not harmful, but it might play on your mind for the rest of your life. So I think, you know, when it comes to just knowing what diet suits you, you should be able to find that out through an element of trial and error. I imagine that, like, when you go for your runs, you know that you can't have certain foods because they might cause, like, digestive upset. So you've probably had an experience where that's gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
And there's just certain things like that. Like, I know that if I have, like, a lot of Greek yogurt, for example, I will be bloated, like 9 months pregnant bloated. And I just know that that's something, although I love it, I can't have it in my diet a lot. And it's the same, you know, with different people. So I think it's really important to, like, tune into your body and what suits you. But also, when it comes to things like, if you do feel like you're extremely tired, regardless if you're getting enough iron in your diet, 100% go to your GP, and then they can look at other things. Because, you know, tiredness could be due to a number of things. Could be your diet, but it could be something more harmful. So it's really, really important that we don't just poo-poo it and think, oh, but I'm getting loads of iron or red meat or whatever.
Yeah, it is confusing. And as you said, we've talked about it before. I'm somebody who's very sensitive to caffeine. Yeah. So, oh my goodness, if I have coffee, it's like rocket fuel for me. And I can't seem to, yeah, I just don't have it anymore ever. But I know other people that, you know, they can have a couple of cups of coffee, or they're used to it or whatever. So I do think, as you said, doing trial and error. And I think, as you said, listening to and, like, looking, I guess, at your own body and how it reacts. So when you said about the bloating, I think sometimes people who are very, maybe they're quite, I don't know if they're fussy, but people that are quite sensitive about, like, what they eat, they don't want to change it. So often people will say, like, oh, if they are tired or if they've got really bad skin, for example, they just want to, like, what face wash can I use? What cream can I use? What they'll ask me, what moisturizer do you use? What makeup? And they want to know more about what's going on the skin, but they don't really want to hear, like, oh, maybe, like, dairy, or maybe if it's a certain food that doesn't suit them, they don't want to look at their diet. They just want to kind of go, no, it's not that. It, you know, just give me a cream to put on or something.
Yeah. And often, unless it's something that's, like, to do with digesting a food or it's happened straight after a meal, we don't really think that diet could be the cause of something. When now, like, you know, 70% of the diseases that we die of worldwide are lifestyle related, and a huge component of that is diet. So what we put in our plate, and in some cases what we put on our plate 3 times a day if we're lucky, it could be contributing to better health, but it could be contributing to poor health. So it's really important that we talk about it. But again, coming back to the whole thing that, like, different people thrive off, you know, different types of diets. There's, like, populations in Japan who are known for, like, you know, incredible longevity, and they have really high carbohydrate diets. But then we're always told, you know, the Mediterranean diet, which is, like, lots of olive oils and nuts and seeds, is the best kind of diet. So really, it you know, it depends. Mm. And although that's not the perfect answer, there's no perfect diet.
Yeah, and I think as you just said about those two different places, I know when people talk about, I guess different groups and populations, they'll talk about the diet, but there's all the other factors that contribute to that mm-hmm. society and how they live. So there might be that, you know, that society might be, that population might be that the women stay at home and cook and the men work, and then they have more maybe community, and they might be, religious-based places where there's lots more community and people coming together. There's lots of things, whether how active they are, you know, there's so many things that contribute to lifelong health, but I think it's really difficult, isn't it, to kind of figure out, well, how much of a part does diet play?
Yeah, that's true. And it's not just what we eat, but how we eat. So, like, are you sitting down enjoying your meals? Are you sitting down and eating it as a family? And like you said, preparing foods and getting kids involved and growing your own vegetables and just having that relationship. But like 100% living like a fast food vending machine diet, which is something that I see a lot in the hospital, that's not going to lead to good health. And I think everyone knows that. But here, especially in London, we're just constantly on the go. That food is always like, while we're on the tube or while we're picking up the kids, while we're doing a million other things, we don't really process what we're doing. And also, if you're not really chewing your food and you're just swallowing it, you're probably not getting as many nutrients as if you were to sit there mindfully chew it, because chewing is the first step in digestion. We forget that.
Yeah, so I think that's interesting for people to take away, is actually instead of just looking at like the next diet or the next superfood or the next pill, actually, like you said, the basic fundamentals of eating, prepare your food, chew it, sit somewhere calm, enjoy the food, not eating on the run, eating on the go, it could be just as important as, like I said, getting the next, I don't know, super pollen grain thing.
Yeah, no, focus on the basics. So, like, you know, have a largely plant-based diet. Like, you don't have to go full hog and go all plants, but if you're having more plants in your diet, you're going to be getting more nutrients, more fiber, and naturally it's going to displace any of the like less nutrient-dense foods. Like, try go for whole grain foods like and brown versions over the white versions. And although that's kind of like something that's been hammered home to us since we've been kids, the reason that people say that is because whole grains have the like everything. They've got like the whole, the bran, the endosperm, and all of the nutrients in there. When you strip a grain of that, you're removing a lot of the fiber, a lot of the nutrients. So if you can try go for kind of like things in their whole form, it's going to be better for you. Get oily fish in there. If you don't eat fish, then try to get like chia seeds, flax seeds, walnuts. They're really rich in omega-3, which we can't make in our body. We need to get it through our food. So it's like focusing on those principles, like more fiber, more veggies, healthy fats, you're going to do good.
Oh my gosh, so much in there, like that whole, you know, timeline journey, so many things from being kicked out of boarding school to party scene and being like a nightclub host and like all of that stuff. And I guess what I was kind of thinking when you were talking is that all of those things, they can be, I don't know if they were for you, can be quite extreme. So even like, I think boarding school, you know, yes, if you were doing three sports, you know, coaching, training, that's structured and disciplined, and then that's gone, and then maybe homeschooling, and then nightclub scene, extreme, and then as you said, partying, entertaining, like, and then even maybe traveling. It seems like you quite enjoy maybe extreme things. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. When I do something, I don't do it in half measures. It's not a conscious thing, it just happens. So when I was partying, I was partying. Equally, when I'm hiking, it's not just, oh, I like to go for a 2-hour hike. It's 5 days by myself in the mountains somewhere. So I don't know. I just like pushing boundaries, I guess.
Yeah, I'm nodding along. I don't know if I'm quite as extreme, but I do think that somebody who, I always say I have an addictive personality, and I always say like it's very fortunate for me that I never, that side of my personality was never drawn to, I don't know, alcohol or drugs or gambling, because I'm similar in if I'm doing something, I'm doing it. I'm doing it 110%. I never just dabble. I'm like, okay, we're doing this now. So you mentioned a little bit about the 2-meal day and how you first discovered intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting, I think, has become very popular in media and especially within the wellness space, I find, in the last 6-12 months. Obviously for you, it's been a lot longer. Mm. So can you tell us, for people maybe listening who don't even know what intermittent fasting is, can you tell us everything, what it is, who is it good for, why is it good for us? Give it to us.
So, you know, fasting just means not eating. People are very afraid of the term, but that's all what fasting means. And intermittent fasting means incorporating periods of not eating into your day or your week. With the 5-2 diet, which is very popular, it's eat normally for 5 days and restrict calories to 600 for 2 days. With what I do, it's actually called time-restricted eating, where you do every day. And I'm aiming for roughly 16 hours every day where I'm not eating. 8 of those hours I'm asleep. The reason I developed the 2-meal day is because if you do focus on the time periods, people often get obsessed. They count down the hours until they can eat. They're not listening to their bodies. And for me, the benefit for intermittent fasting is just learning to listen to your body again and learning to understand what hunger actually is. And you only really realize what hunger is when you go through a few hours every day without eating. You realize perceived hunger comes and goes throughout the day. And you realize it's habit, it's routine, it's boredom, it's emotional. It's you have to have your lunch at this time, you have to have your snack at this time. So, you know, that's in a nutshell what intermittent fasting is. I think it's great for people. I think it's great for most people. But I think if you've got any underlying health issue, of course, then you're going to have some issues potentially, especially diabetes. Anyone with a history of eating disorders and pregnant and breastfeeding women should avoid it. But essentially, it's nothing extreme. For me, what's extreme is that people can't go 4 hours without eating and crashing and feeling hangry. And this has become the social norm.
Yep.
But in actual fact, that is not normal. That's not how we're meant to function. And there's an initial few days, which can be difficult, where you go from being primarily fueled by the carbohydrates in food to tapping into your stored energy, which is carbohydrates and glycogen, but fat as well. And that's a completely normal thing. But we kind of have to retrain our bodies to do that and to function optimally without eating every hour.
I agree with the social conditioning aspect in the sense that we have been told, you know, you eat breakfast at this time, or you need to constantly have snacks, or you need to eat 3 meals a day or this time. And I think that we obviously get used to habits, right? We're creatures of habit. We like to. And it's funny what you said then about feeling hunger, because it's interesting. I think for a long time, you know, you don't feel hunger from a lot of people on a daily basis. You don't feel hunger.
No.
And then it's only when
real
hunger. And I think for me, about 2 years ago when I first started going, you know, plant-based, and I stopped eating animal products, and I was kind of experimenting with, well, what can I eat? Where can I get food? What can I snack? And it's different now. You know, there's so much stuff available.
Yeah.
But I actually was going on a long-haul flight. I hadn't really planned it that well, and I hadn't pre-ordered a vegan meal. So on that flight, I basically didn't have any food. I think I had maybe some almonds. And it was like maybe 12 hours, and I was hungry. And I sat there and I thought, actually, it's so strange that I'd never feel hunger. And I thought, what an incredible, you know, how lucky you are if you can, you know, some people around the world do experience hunger every day. And so that's what I kind of sat with. I thought, you know what? Some people feel hunger every single day and you're not used to this feeling. And yeah, I think that's something to really think about. But what are the health benefits of intermittent fasting?
So for me, I normally focused on the three main things that people feel on a day-to-day basis. And this is, yes, the reason people get into it is weight loss or fat loss. It's effective for maintaining a calorie deficit effortlessly. I'll explain why in a bit. The second thing is you have more energy overall. And this sounds counterintuitive, but once you're tapping into your stored body fat, it's endless, the energy pretty much. I mean, I worked out that I have roughly 50,000 calories worth of energy to tap into in the form of fat, and I have a low body fat. So, you know, that's pretty much endless. You're not going to exhaust that even after a week of not eating, pretty much, which I'm not encouraging, by the way. And then because you stop associating food with energy, and this is a subconscious thing, you don't notice it, because you're using your fat reserves, you then feel less hungry overall. And the combination of these three benefits, I think, is the reason why it's become so popular. Not only are you losing weight, you feel less hungry and you have more energy, which, you know, for people that have dieted, I put in inverted commas, you know, that's unheard of, and is actually the reason it becomes a way of life rather than a crash diet when done correctly. You know, when it comes to like the more profound health benefits, it can improve insulin sensitivity. It can potentially improve gut bacteria because you're allowing your digestion to have a break. It can potentially, it's being looked at for reversing type 2 diabetes and things like this. But this is very early doors, and that's not what I focus on, and that's not you know, there's still a lot more research that needs to be done. But I think the three main benefits of losing weight, having feeling less hungry, and having more energy is a game changer.
Okay, so you know you said dieting in quotations. What would you say to people that say, well, intermittent fasting is a diet, it's another kind of trend or fad or diet that people are going to try, and then, you know, like people have talked, you know, a lot at the moment, the conversation around diet culture and how we should be avoiding that. And do you think that this is a diet or it's not a diet?
No, well, it really depends how you do it. I mean, if you're doing the 16-8 or the 5-2, that's a very much a diet. Mm. It's restrictive. You're telling yourself that, you know, I'm not eating for 16 hours and I can't eat until this time. With a 2-meal day, I try to encourage it to become a way of life. So it's not, you know, oh, I can't eat until this time. It's like, don't, you know, skip one meal. And, you know, people say that I skip breakfast. I don't actually skip breakfast. Breakfast just means breaking your fast. Mm-hmm. So I break my fast later. People are always like, what time do you break your fast? You know, when is it? Whenever I feel hungry. Mm-hmm. So it might be 11 o'clock. It might be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It really depends. So, you know, for me, it sounds really complicated, intermittent fasting. People overcomplicate it. But actually, it's very simple. You just learn to eat when you're hungry. And I think that's the opposite of a diet. You know, I think that is, on one hand, we've got health professionals. You've got, you know, the English, the British, I can't remember the name of the exact group that are encouraging this, but Britain needs to go on a diet. You know, mm-hmm. everyone needs to eat less. But on the other hand, they're saying you have to have breakfast. And like lots of people aren't hungry in the morning.
Yeah.
Like you said yourself just before, you kind of naturally do it. And that's because it's a more natural way of eating. You're someone that has probably learned to eat when they're hungry. So yeah, long-winded answer, but I think it's not a fad if you can incorporate it into your entire life and approach it in the right way and learn to listen to your body.
Yeah. So, yeah, for me personally, I think I do intermittent fasting unintentionally sometimes, not all the time. Mm. And I've got to be honest, I think because I get up early, so most of the time I'm up by 5:30, I train in the mornings, I'll then come back, I might have something to do, take my son to school, I might then, you know, have something, an appointment, a meeting, a train, and then often I'll break my fast, if you like, at maybe 10 a.m.
Yeah.
Or it might be 10:30. So to me, I would count that as my breakfast, whatever that is. Mm. But yeah, I've been up since 5:30, so I don't just open my eyes, go into the kitchen and prepare food, and that's just, it's not like necessarily a conscious choice, but I have had people reach out to me before, especially because I run and I post that on Instagram stories, saying, do you eat before you run? So do you consciously fast when you run? And I'm like, no. I'm like, I just get up and just go for a run.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, but on the other side of that, sometimes, like if I go on holiday or if I'm staying in a hotel and I get up and there's like a really beautiful breakfast buffet, I'll go and have a really big breakfast. Mm. Or sometimes I just wake up hungry. So yeah, I think the intuitive point is really, really important.
Well, there's this whole argument about intuitive eating, which I agree with, but I don't understand how you can intuitively eat and understand what hunger is if you're eating regularly throughout the day.
Yeah.
The only thing that can teach intuitive eating, in my opinion, is intermittent fasting, because then you actually understand what your body needs and when it needs it.
Mm, and feeling hunger. Although I will say to you, Max, I'm not really sure I've got this down, because there was a day a couple of weeks ago where I hadn't planned my morning very well, and I hadn't eaten in the morning, and then I was back to back, and it got to maybe 12:30, maybe even 1, and I was so hungry that I then was like, oh my gosh, I've had nothing to eat all day, and I probably ate breakfast, lunch and a snack all in one sitting to kind of make up for the fact that I'd missed it. So yeah, do you feel like people get more hungry then and eat more?
So this is the thing about intermittent fasting. The theory was that if you skip breakfast, you end up overcompensating later in the day and actually you end up eating more. But actually they've done some at Bath University, James Betts has done a lot of research on this, and that's just not the case. Although it feels like you're over consuming, overall you're still eating less than if you were having a meal. And this is why it's such a game changer for me, is like, what you're eating. For me, I eat two large meals and I'm really full and satisfied at the end, sometimes a snack in between those two meals, but overall I'm still eating a bit less. And you know, initially it can feel like you're really going crazy, but after you get used to it, you know, you don't have that kind of you know, you don't binge as it were, but also it does take some more organization. So especially at the beginning, you have to make sure that you're breaking your fast with quality, nutrient dense foods if possible, and there's
not
a decent
like a
amount of it. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that, you know, I teach to my clients, is make sure that ideally that you're bringing in some food with you that you've prepared the night before. So if it does get to 11 o'clock and you are desperate, then you have that rather than running into whatever convenience store that's near you.
Yeah, awesome. So when you work with your clients one-to-one, if they've never heard of, you know, fasting before, or the concept, or they've ever tried it, what are some of their, you know, their initial response, and what are some of the common barriers that people face when they first start making these changes?
Firstly, I wouldn't automatically recommend the 2-meal-a-day intermittent fasting to every client. Mm-hmm. It really depends on their goals, their eating habits, their relationship with food. Usually people have heard of it and have heard of me anyway, so they're fairly open to it. But yeah, it's not a case of me having to persuade people necessarily. I'll advise it if I think it's the right thing to do. I think for some people initially it's not the right thing to do, because one of the issues that people have with fasting when they first start doing it is they're doing too many things at once. Mm-hmm. You know, they decide to start training 5-6 times a week, they're eating less meat, they're cutting out alcohol, you know, at the same time as not fixing their sleep, and then they start, you know, intermittent fasting on top of these things. So it's about incorporating these principles that I talk about sustainably and one by one. So I'd say, you know, the initial barriers that I come across to the average person who find out about what I'm talking about is, but breakfast is the most important meal of the day, isn't it? And aren't you so hungry? And probably the biggest one is, oh, but I love food too much. You know, I couldn't do that. You know, I love food more than anyone.
Me too.
I grow my own vegetables. Yeah. I source from local farms. I love cooking. I love sharing it with people. And actually, I find my appreciation of food has increased because I eat less often. So when I do eat, it's more special. But yeah, so there are things that people say. I think people generally are becoming more aware of it. You know, the breakfast is the most important of the day. All stems from cereal companies in the mm-hmm. 1900s. Creating the first highly profitable processed food, cereal, alongside the cereal. It was the Kellogg brothers. They were super religious, and they came all these marketing techniques and health claims, like it would stop you from masturbating, it would stop you from doing all... Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I never heard that one.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
I have heard before that this concept of, you know, not conspiracy, but people saying, you know, the breakfast is the whole most important meal thing, yeah, was created by cereal companies and also the farming industry, encouraging you to have your glass of milk and your Rice Krispies or your cornflakes. And yeah, I guess they did a very, very good marketing job, because here we are, however many...
People still saying
it. Yeah, people still say it, and people still believe it.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In my clinic, I was seeing people, really intelligent people, you know, having very, very restrictive diets because they'd gotten tests that had said they were intolerant to pretty much every food under the sun. And then other people were having these high dose supplements that were causing gut issues. So, you know, the organ that I saw had so much power and potential was actually being misrepresented. So I moved more into social media, and yeah, so many things have come from that.
Brilliant. Well, I honestly have so many questions about this, because I think, rightly, as you said, we're going to come on to talking about, you know, the myths, the do's, the don'ts, because I think with gut health, although it's a good thing that it's become more popular and more mainstream and people are acknowledging the importance of it, I think what comes with that, as you said, is a lot of misinformation, a lot of contradictory and kind of extreme things as well. And I think for a lot of people, myself included, actually, you know, I've done a few episodes now with different doctors, different sleep doctor, nutrition doctor, food nutritionist, and often, you know, people have health anxiety, and when they get so fed so much different information, it can actually make you like more stressed out, more worried, because you're thinking, okay, I should be eating this and drinking that and taking this supplement and giving this to my child and this daily, and then you're like, oh, but the complete opposite research or some different science and some different evidence suggests the complete opposite, and doing all these things is detrimental, and it can be very stressful. So as you are the gut doctor, could you please, I guess, just give us like the basics, the 101, the good, the bad and in between of gut health, and what we should, I guess, be striving for optimum gut health?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. And I think the best way to start this off is, you know, thinking about what actually is gut health, because it's in the media all the time, but what it is isn't often communicated. So gut health actually relates to the functioning of our entire digestive tract, which is a tube that delivers food from entry all the way to exit. So that's that 9-meter long tube. And I guess if I was to summarize all of the evidence at the moment, there's really three reasons why gut health is just so important for us. The first reason is, you know, the good old saying, you are what you eat, isn't necessarily true. It's more about you are what you digest. So if you're, you know, eating the most healthiest foods, but you don't have a good gut lining, then you're actually not going to extract that nutrition and absorb it into your body. So good gut health is actually really important to get the most out of the food that you're eating. The second element is the fact that along that 9-meter long digestive tract lays 70% of our immune system.
Wow.
So if we want less sick days, a stronger, you know, immune system, then we need to look after our gut health. And then the third element, which has really brought the fame, I guess, to the concept of gut health, is the fact that we all have trillions of microbes, including the bacteria, that live in the lower part of our intestine. And the scientific word for that is called our gut microbiota. And it's kind of nearly considered to be an own, like an organ in its own right.
I've definitely listened to a lot of podcasts about this gut microbiome, and about, I was even at a wellness festival earlier this year where there was a company that you could essentially send off a stool sample and they would, you know, look into your microbiome and send you back all this information. And it seems that, yeah, apparently it's the, like, I don't know, the map, we can see everything from this. Also, I think, you know, listening to what you were saying then from the science element, I'm also thinking, you know, even from like a holistic approach, from, you know, looking back centuries, people have always said, you know, listen to your gut, or, you know, the gut is the second brain, or it kind of, you know, that thing of having a nervous stomach or having butterflies, or, you know, it's connected emotionally, it's connected
Absolutely.
To our I guess it's all connected. It's more than, as you said, just you are what you eat, or just about food and nutrition. So yeah, I guess what are the things that we should be striving for to have good gut health, and what are the red flags that our gut health needs to improve?
Yeah. So firstly, just touching on the test that you mentioned, because there are a lot of companies doing this, and I think it's really important to be aware that the research isn't quite there yet. So it's a bit of a case of, you know, commercialization is ahead of the research. So in my research world, I certainly do collect poop samples. We do the analysis, but we don't just look at what bacteria are there, which is kind of what those commercial tests do. We actually look at what the bacteria are doing. And the reason why that's an important difference is because two very different bacteria can actually do the same functions. And similarly, the identical same bacteria can act very different in different environments. So just looking at what bacteria you have in you, you know, doesn't offer us a lot of information. In fact, it can just kind of freak some people out and go, oh, I'm missing something, I need more of this. So at the moment, I don't recommend people get those tests done. But I think definitely in the next couple of years, we will know a lot more from those sorts of tests. Mm-hmm. So how do we look after our gut? Well, I think we know that one of the most important things for gut health is our diet. Because, you know, our bacteria in our gut relies on us to feed it, essentially. So it's kind of like this little inner universe of potential, or a little pet that we need to nourish. So where the evidence stands in terms of the diet is actually about being not restrictive. And I think a lot of people think, oh, if I need good gut health, I have to cut everything out. It's actually about being more inclusive. So what I currently recommend, according to the science, is that people try to get around 30 different plant-based foods in their diet a week. Now, I know that can sound really intimidating. People go, oh my God, that's impossible. But things like, you know, on your breakfast, whatever you're having, add a teaspoon of mixed seeds. You get 4 points there. Instead of just getting, you know, the steamed broccoli, get the multi-veggie pack. And then you get another like 3 points. So just those small little switches, you actually can achieve that. And the reason the diversity is important is because, you know, like us, our bacteria have all different taste preferences. So each different plant-based food has slightly different nutrients for the different bacteria. And if we want a really diverse range of bacteria in our gut, which is associated with, you know, better weight management, better heart health, etc., better mental health also is really important, then we need to feed them that diverse range of food so they're all happy and they can grow together.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds great. I've heard it described before as well as a jungle. Yeah. You know, that you've got to have a variety of all the different plants. And as you said, like, you need to eat a variety as well to match that. So what would be some, I guess, yeah, red flags or things to look out for that people should, you know, kind of not be worried about, but just kind of say, okay, maybe you could improve a little bit on your gut health?
Yeah. So there's many other things that are non-diet related that we know certainly can impact on our gut health. Things like stress, and that's all via that gut-brain axis. So our gut and our brain are constantly communicating. And that's why, as you said, you know, we get nervous, we can feel it in our belly, even though the nervousness is just in our head. But it's bi-directional, so our gut can also talk to our brain. So I think, you know, trying to manage the stress can also be really important for looking after your gut health, whether it's with things like mindfulness. Exercise is also a really great one. Sleep is another hugely important one, because like our human cells, they have a body clock according to the circadian rhythm, so does our gut bacteria. So getting your 7 to 9 hours is also really, really important. If we were to look at diet, my research group at Kang's is currently looking at some of the food additives and looking at whether they're, how they're impacting our gut bacteria. And we think they're probably not doing a lot of good for us. So I guess moving away from those processed foods, which I think most of us know is probably not good for overall health anyway, but we're more trying to understand the mechanisms and why they might not be as good as what we had hoped.
Okay, cool. So yeah, lifestyle things, I think, so important. Diet, sleep, exercise, as you mentioned. What about genetics? You know, sometimes people tend to throw that word out sometimes as an excuse. It's like, oh, genetics, there's nothing you can do. Like, I've even heard people say to me before, you know, when it comes to diet and exercise and all the rest of it, I hear what you're saying, Adrienne. We know what's good and bad. But at the end of the day, sometimes if your genetics are this, then that's it. So what do you think?
Yeah, look, the thing that I find so empowering about our gut health is that so much is in our own hands. So unlike our genetics, we can't actually change our genes, but we can change the bacteria. And we know the bacteria do so many different things for us. So if we look after it, it can produce the right sort of vitamins and minerals. It can help with our blood sugar regulation and our appetite control. So actually, our gut microbiota is an organ we can have so much impact on, and that can improve the health and happiness of the rest of our body. So I do certainly think that a lot of that power's in our hand. In saying that, there are certain conditions like inflammatory bowel disease where there is a genetic component, but we also know that there's an environmental factor which kind of switches those genes on. So just because you have the genes for it doesn't necessarily mean you'll get it, but there might be something in the environment, whether it's things like food additives or, you know, the pollution or something like that, which kind of switches those genes on. So there definitely is a combination, but yeah, I don't think people, you know, should be blaming everything on their genes. There's certainly things that people can do to improve their health.
That's awesome to hear. Yeah, taking it into your own hands and feeling empowered to make changes with the knowledge that it's going to have a positive impact, I think is really powerful. What about this? I read something recently about when you, if you live in an area where there's lots of woods, lots of trees, lots of grass, and you walk through that area and you breathe through your nose, that apparently is good for the gut. And I was kind of thinking, okay, because you're breathing through your respiratory system, but it's still affecting the gut. Is this true? Is this a myth? Is this a fad?
No, we certainly do see that people who, you know, play outdoors, work outdoors, actually do tend to have a more diverse range of gut bacteria in their gut, which, remember, is associated with better overall health. And the thing that people don't really realize is that there are microbes everywhere. In fact, we actually have a skin microbiota. So on our skin, it's kind of like a second skin. It's invisible because you can't see the microbes to the human eye, but there are millions of microbes. And that's why, you know, there are some research suggesting that things like maybe topical probiotics may help with things like acne or eczema, etc., because it's targeting the bacteria on the skin. So if you go out in the woods, there's a diverse range of different microbes there. So you're breathing them in and they're getting into your system, and therefore adding kind of to that collective community that you're growing. And remember, it's kind of like a football team. You want to have as much diverse skills as you can inside of you.
Amazing. I'm so happy that you just confirmed that for me, because essentially I walk my son through woods to school. It's only a short walk, but I told him about it. And so now when we walk through, we're always like, inhale the microbes.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Crazy,
yeah.
Mum, but I'm literally like, I'm glad that I wasn't just making that up. It's true. It's true.
It's very true. And, you know, playing in dirt and all that sort of stuff, there's the hygiene hypothesis suggesting that, you know, because, you know, 10 years, 20 years ago, we were quite actually clean with our kids. They didn't play in dirt. We were, you know, getting the spray and wipes and things like that. Their body wasn't actually exposed to the different microbes. And the microbes are so important for training our immune system. Remember, 70% lays along our digestive tract. So if we don't have a range of different exposures to the bacteria, particularly in the first 3 years of life, then our immune system isn't trained correctly, and then we're at high risk of things like allergies and other autoimmune conditions, and even obesity, in fact.
Wow, okay. Yeah, I've heard a lot about this with the kind of antibacterial hand gels, the kind of, you know, wipes, as you said, for everything, washing hands. It's actually kind of, yeah, I guess, pendulumed almost too far.
Yeah.
And we do need, I guess, yeah, some dirt and some bacteria, right?
Yeah.
So on that, I would love to talk to you, Megan, about probiotics and prebiotics. Oh my goodness, the amount of information. I feel like I could do a whole show just on this, but the amount of information that's out there. And I recently listened to the two scientists debating, saying that, you know, this whole prebiotic probiotic is actually just companies selling you products that are very expensive, that do absolutely nothing. He was arguing that they do nothing and that they're not essential at all, whereas others will say everybody, absolutely everywhere, should be taking a daily probiotic. So what's going on?
Yeah. So firstly, there is so much confusion about them because they sound very similar, but they're actually very different things. So although there's only one letter that separates them, so prebiotic, P-R-E-biotic, is essentially like food for the good bacteria, like fertilizer. And the probiotic, P-R-O-biotic, is actually the live microbes. So I think there certainly has been a lot of overhype in the media about these two words, but there is some evidence in some conditions. Now, when it comes to prebiotics, so the food for the bacteria, I very, very rarely recommend people need to take a supplement. Prebiotics are in all of the plant-based foods that we eat. So that's, again, bringing back to the reason why we need that diversity, because all the different types of plant-based foods contain slightly different prebiotics. So the average person out there, I certainly would not recommend a prebiotic supplement. There are some conditions, like I said, in my clinical practice where I would recommend, but very few. And then when it comes to probiotics, the actual bacteria, again, there isn't evidence to suggest that if you are healthy that you should be taking one of these capsules. In fact, I'm very anti that. I think getting, you know, some extra microbes in your diet through fermented food is a really good idea, like kefir. It's my favorite. It takes literally 2 minutes to make it. They've got heaps of recipes in the book. And, you know, other sorts of fermented foods like natto is quite a strong taste, but things like kimchi and sauerkraut and stuff. So including that sort of stuff, and even live yogurt. So traditional Greek yogurt contains some bacteria.
Well, as yogurt was on my list, because yeah. I feel like so many yogurts now just say like probiotic, and you kind of think, what is that? Do I even need it? And there's all these words about, you know, like Activia this and like, oh no, what is it? Activia bifilaris, all these things
that
just tell you like, this is going to make your gut happy.
Yeah,
and you're like, what are you talking about? It's just, it feels like it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think eat them because you enjoy them and they're super tasty. And then any health benefits, I think, is just an addition.
This concept of food as medicine has been around since the beginning of time, but somewhere along the way, the modern world seems to have become disconnected from this way of thinking. So we've developed so many different types of medications, painkillers, steroids, vaccinations, antibiotics, and many of these I'm sure are essential, but we've moved towards a much more clinical way of looking at medicine. However, are we now pivoting again and returning to the idea that food, plants, and nature really do hold the keys to good health? Why do you think that we're now going back to looking at food as medicine?
It's a really interesting question, and I think it's a topic that comes up a lot amongst my medical colleagues, particularly those who are interested in lifestyle medicine. And I believe that around 50 or 60 years ago, there was a renaissance within medicine. You know, we started using antibiotics. We saw the incredible impact of antimicrobials and how we rid ourselves of infections that would otherwise be a death sentence in a lot of people. Sanitation obviously has a role. Vaccination has a role. A whole bunch of other things. But medicine was really hailed as this huge futuristic technology that would enable us to live the healthiest life. And that's where I think there was a general sort of consensus that what the doctor does and what healthcare provides us with in modern healthcare can be absolutely phenomenal. And I think The balance of that and just how much trust and effort we put into healthcare, the balance of that has shifted now that we're witnessing a rise of different sorts of diseases. So chronic lifestyle-related diseases, those like high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, fueled by an industry that is unfortunately related to big food manufacturers, is now overpowering what healthcare can provide. And the solutions that we've traditionally held in the form of a pill, in the form of quick fixes almost, don't apply to this new generation of chronic illness. And unfortunately, because of our obesogenic environment and something that I coined called the psychogenic environment, which is an environment that predisposes us to a lot of psychological issues, unfortunately, it is just something that requires much more of a holistic and balanced perspective than just asking for a pill. I think also we, and I like to use this term homeostasis quite a bit, it's basically the process by which organisms maintain equilibrium. And I think it's never black or white. There's always like a combination of two things. I use pharmaceuticals, not personally every day, but obviously with patients, but I also give them the added benefit of lifestyle advice. And there is so much that we can use each other as complements rather than one or the other. And I think, you know, we like to make things black and white, but actually it's really about balance. It's really about this homeostatic sort of concept.
Yeah, I think that's really important actually that you mentioned that, because what I would never want for people to think is that, as you said, it's not, they're not mutually exclusive. It's not one without the other. They both can benefit each other, because of course there are conditions that require for you to take a daily medication, for some people maybe more than one. And it's not to say that, I know that, I think there's quite, you know, extremes within media and within documentaries that will say, you know, look at this person, they were taking these tablets, then they changed their diet, they threw their tablets in the bin.
Yeah.
And I think that can also be very irresponsible, because yeah, if you need a medication you know, daily, I'm sure changing your diet can have a huge impact, but it might not necessarily mean that you're going to be able to just, you know, rid yourself of your prescription. You know, it might be kind of dangerous for you to do that, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that's why I think initially when I came out with the doctor's kitchen, I was quite worried that people would just think it's a doctor and he's throwing away medications in the way of like by replacing them with fruits and vegetables, which, and I can understand that it sounds almost paradoxical. The doctor's kitchen, he's a doctor, isn't he, meant to be peddling drugs, and he's doing stuff in the kitchen? That doesn't sound like it should be together, but it is. And we love paradoxes, and I think the doctor's kitchen is really a great metaphor, just those three words, for what I do and what I believe, because I think a lot of people can be helped by both systems, by both conventional and traditional medicine, for want of a better word. And I think overall, in the future, maybe in the next 5-10 years even, if I am successful with culinary medicine and all the other stuff that I'm doing, that it will just be labeled medicine.
Yeah.
It's just good medicine.
Yeah. And it's really interesting as well, going back to what you said about 50, 60 years ago with the medicine and the industry, because, you know, I feel like with the older generations in my family, they definitely have this kind of conditioning and this respect for doctors, and they trust the information that they are told without questioning it. They trust it blindly, because if a doctor tells you something, that it's correct, 100%, the GP said, you know, and that comes down to everything from take this tablet to, you know, vaccinations to flu jabs to anything. If it's NHS and the GP says it, they take it as gospel. But I think the younger generation and people that I see are kind of taking more responsibility perhaps for their own health, and they might be doing more research into alternative treatments and into looking at their lifestyle, looking at their diet. They might be more reluctant to take antibiotics or to get vaccinations. And I don't know what you think about this. Is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? You know, are we all getting a bit carried away with relying too much on the internet and, you know, Googling things and getting our own medical advice and perhaps just looking at our favorite blogger's recommendation, you know?
Yeah.
When really, you know, as you said, do we need that balance somewhere?
It's a really good question. I think what we're witnessing is the democratization of information via the internet. And the internet is a very powerful thing. And I think while some people would heed warning in totality, and that, you know, you shouldn't listen to anything you come across on the internet without putting it past your doctor first, I think, yes, that there are some sensible things actually you can glean from the internet. I, using myself as an example, have learnt a ton of things by using an analytical, critical approach from the internet. However, I'm very aware that people who don't have such skills can be lured towards things that can be unsafe for a lot of people. So again, it comes down to balance of where we get the information from and knowing who to trust and where and how to get this information. What the other thing I think is really important to note is the concept of science, really, and the skepticism and the challenges are things that we need to embrace as scientists. You know, when I'm challenged by someone who doesn't believe what I'm suggesting or prescribing, it doesn't infuriate me. It makes me a lot more open-minded, and I think that's a perspective that a lot of doctors need to take. And traditionally, you were saying, you know, the older generations just believe anything that doctors said. Well, you know, whilst I appreciate that's great, because back then they didn't know anywhere else to get the information. Now it pushes us as doctors to look else outside, beyond the sources that are just given to us at medical school. Even as doctors, I think we need to embrace challenges from our patients, because it does make us more open-minded. And it's not just a case of believing everything that we're spoon-fed from medical school. In fact, on the first day of medical school, I remember being told that 50% of what we were going to be taught over the next 5-6 years is going to be incorrect by the end of it.
Because it changes constantly.
It changes constantly. Yeah. And the prevailing scientific bias can change. It doesn't change often, doesn't change by much, but it does change. What we believed 20 years ago about fat, for example, and demonizing all types of fats completely changed. And the same way, you know, the medications that we used to prescribe for years and years are now completely revolutionized. And the way I think we're going to be treating patients in the future is definitely going to involve a lot more holistic medicine or lifestyle medicine, or call it whatever you want. It's going to be including a lot of lifestyle practices and food as medicine, because we are embracing the challenges that we're seeing. You know, I think one of the reasons that a lot more people are joining the conversation is because the patients are demanding more than a quick pharmaceutical fix. And that may be born out of some unsavory articles that they've read about on the internet, and not everyone has the best intentions. You know, there's a huge supplement industry out there that's capitalizing on people's fears of being micronutrient deficient, or that they're at risk from environmental pollutants. But at the same time, we have to be a lot more sort of aware of the different sorts of things that are going on in our environment. And I think we're not taught that medical school, and it's a constant learning process. So by virtue of being a scientist, we have to embrace skepticism.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's really, really powerful. I hope that people are really hearing what you're saying and listening to that. And I think that that's important, as you said, for people who are at medical school or who are doctors, because I think maybe it's more of an old school thing, as I was saying, with the generation, but also with the doctors as well. You know, if you do go to your GP and, you know, they, I guess, they don't know you. They don't know your history. They might not know your lifestyle habits. Obviously, they have a limited amount of time, you know, working in the NHS. As I said, I have friends who work in the NHS. I have so much respect for you all, because it's incredibly, you know, demanding. It's such long hours. It's so hard for them, especially in a general practice. For somebody to walk in, you have 10 minutes. You've got, a baby with a rash. Then you've got an old lady with a sore knee. Then you've got a man with a cough. And it's like, they don't have that much time. And I think actually, if we can take responsibility and even go in with more information, that's like, this is the, you know, like you said about keeping a journal of your symptoms, or a journal of, you know, when you felt that, or what foods you're eating or whatever, might actually help the doctor to help you.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And I think it's a really good point you raised there, because I don't think a lot of people recognize just how many people we see per day. So when I'm doing a full day of clinic, you know, I'll be seeing upwards of 40 patients a day, which is unprecedented in all sort of specialties, actually. GPs see the most, because we are frontline clinicians. And you're right, it can be the old person with a cough or the baby with a rash. And when we're looking at that patient, the first thing I'm thinking of is the red flag. Is this cough lung cancer? Or is that rash meningitis? Or have I just let a chest pain go that could be cardiac? You know, and there's so many other things, and this is why I run late all the time, because on top of that, on top of just like making sure it's nothing serious, I need to factor in the lifestyle stuff. How am I going to promote health as well as prevent disease? And I think those are things that, you know, a lot of people struggle with to kind of understand the concept and the demands that we're under as clinicians. So yes, creating a culture that embraces the medicinal effects of eating well will certainly lessen the burden on the NHS and healthcare systems globally, which is why I'm so passionate about this. Because what I believe, and the thing that I believe that a lot of people do not believe, is the key to health and the key to reversing this huge overburdened system is food. It all comes down to food.
I really agree with you. So talk to us about culinary medicine. So culinary medicine is your course. And do you think that this could become a part of future education for medics?
Yeah, so I'm really pleased to say that it kind of already has.
Wow.
In a very small way, we've kind of like, we've lit the first candle, but we've a long way to go. Like, we have a bonfire to create here. So culinary medicine, like you put it, is where we teach medical students and doctors clinical nutrition, as well as the practical skills of how to cook. And this is a concept that's actually come out of America, of all places, about 7 years ago. There was a medical school called Tulane, and they started a culinary medicine course where they taught their medical students as an optional elective alongside dietetic students in a culinary school kitchen fit for purpose, because they had a benefactor who gave them, like, I think it was like $250,000. And that course became so popular that it's now part of compulsory medical education there and 40 other medical schools in the US, which in context is around a quarter of all medical schools in the US.
Wow.
In the UK, we are really far behind.
Way behind, yeah.
But in summer of this year in Bristol, we ran the first culinary medicine course. It was 4 weeks of intense training where 2 days a week we got them in the kitchen. We got 10 students in the kitchen cooking recipes from scratch. We had a dietitian there who's registered with BDA. We had a culinary chef in the community kitchen teaching the recipes, as well as the skepticism around the subject, how we fit this information in the context of a small, like time-limited consultation in a hospital, in a community, or even in GP clinics, as well as putting them into health clinics and actually getting them to speak to patients directly and asking them about what prevents them from getting fruits and veggies on their plates. Is it cost? Is it time? Is it lack of education? Is it all these different things? And these guys, honestly, are the first cohort of the new generation of doctors or future doctors that are going to be confident to talk about clinical nutrition, to talk about food and medicine with their patients. And it's about expanding and scaling that across all 32 medical schools in the UK, as well as providing that information and that educational experience to the current qualified doctors who are interested in lifestyle medicine, but also those who are skeptical as well.
Yeah, that's really powerful. This, congratulations, because, you know, it sounds absolutely amazing. And I think that the two together, you know, being delivered that information from a qualified doctor, from your GP, I do think carries so much more weight. Because personally, I think within my own life, you know, relationships within my own family, I know there's people who I, you know, I want to see them change their lifestyle habits. I want them to improve their lifestyle habits. But I think often when it comes from me, they think, oh, Adrienne, you know, you run marathons and you don't eat this. And they think that I'm like extreme, you know, yeah. And I'm trying to kind of, I think coming from me, it's not, you know, they need to hear it from somebody else, that it's not an extreme. You don't have to run a marathon. You don't have to be plant-based. You don't have to, you know, completely give up, I don't know, caffeine or alcohol or whatever. But I do think that, as you said, just kind of having a skeptical mind that completely eliminates your diet and your lifestyle. So if you have a headache, oh, it's nothing to do with that. Or if you have, I don't know, constant, you know, stomach issues and digestive issues, it's like, oh, well, I just have IBS, or I just have this heartburn all the time. And just accepting that, well, I can just take a Remy or whatever it's called, or, you know, like you said, a pill, instead of going, well, actually, what's causing that? And can I change it myself through diet? I think this is just super, super powerful. And I really hope people can take some of this, not just from today, from this episode, but, you know, moving forward in the future.
In their own lives, yeah. And it's interesting, the things that you just noted there, IBS, gastritis, high blood pressure, you know, all these things are in the guidelines. So the National Institute of Clinical Excellence guidelines, we are always taught to consider diet and lifestyle in all those conditions. However, if you're not taught at medical school, if you're not taught at postgraduate level, the first thing that we're going to jump to really is going to be a pharmaceutical option. And you put your clinicians in a time-restricted environment, of course you're going to reach for the pharmaceutical option. Of course you're going to reach for this prescription pad. So really, it's about making doctors more nutrition literate without having to use the nutritional science speak. Because I don't speak to my patients about carbohydrate ratios or specific phytochemicals. I speak to them about food. because people can relate to food. If I say, you know, get some more beets and peas and asparagus in your diet, they're in season at the moment, they're gonna understand that. They're gonna go to whatever the supermarket is and they're gonna use a recipe. Whereas if I say, oh, you know what, you need to reduce your carbohydrate ratio, make sure you're having not as many saturated fats and remove all trans fats from your diet, they're not gonna know what I'm talking about, especially when we talk about calorie counting as well. And that's what, and this myopic focus on things like calories and energy balance, you know, it's frustrating for a lot of people because it doesn't actually give them actionable tips. It doesn't give them actionable advice about how they can improve their diet using their plates. Yeah. And this is something that we speak about in the course at the moment. So my sort of aspiration is to create culinary medicine as the standard in all medical education, so we can talk confidently about nutrition, but also how we can actually extrapolate that to them teaching their patients about how they can use food and medicine.
Thank you so much for listening and for supporting the Power Hour podcast. I cannot wait to get back in the studio and start recording new episodes with new guests very soon. But in the meantime, I am head down working hard on the Power Hour book. The book is out at the end of this year, but it is already available for pre-order at Waterstones and Amazon.com. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and have a fantastic week. See ya.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.